Hello, and thanks for joining us for this month's edition of The Scope of Things, a no-nonsense look at the realities and enigmas of clinical research based on those closest to the action who aim for great and, if need be, are willing to shake things up. I'm Deborah Borfitz, Senior Science Writer for Clinical Research News. On today's episode, we have Dennis Salati, Executive Director and Head, Clinical Outsourcing and Innovation at Jazz Pharmaceuticals, who is going to be sharing what he knows about the complexities of the vendor qualification process and the differing ways sponsors and CROs are going about this expensive and time-consuming exercise. Welcome to the podcast, Dennis. So happy you could join us.
Thanks, Deb. Appreciate you having me.
You bet. As you well know, because you helped author a report on the topic with Ken Getz at the Tufts Center for the Study of Drug Development a few years back now, companies are spending a great deal of time and money on the vendor qualification process, and the level of this activity has been escalating for a whole slew of reasons. Presumably related to the growing number of vendors in the space, data privacy and security concerns, and the need to meet regulatory requirements, often across a large number of countries. Can you start us off with sort of the lay of the land when it comes to the deceivingly simple business of selecting a vendor to do business with?
Sure. And I think it's an excellent way to frame it as deceivingly simple. I think at face value, it sounds fairly simple, right? We've all contracted out work at some point or another in our lives. Maybe we've had a room painted or put on an addition to our house. But selecting a vendor for clinical trial work is more complicated. It's more than just getting a couple of bids or getting a referral from a friend or a colleague. The decision or the goal of a vendor selection is to make the best decision for your company, whether it's for your portfolio in its entirety, whether it's for a given program or a specific trial. And there are specific requirements and nuances around making that decision. And so effectively, I think, you know, when we're looking at vendor qualification and then the downstream decision on selecting a vendor, it becomes effectively a de-risking exercise. You mentioned some of the key kind of enterprise risk areas. What you're trying to really do is ask the right questions and get the right information to de-risk your ultimate decision. And what I've seen, just stepping back from it and looking at the landscape, is that the breadth and the complexity of the risks that we need to address and the complexity and the breadth of the decisions we're making have grown kind of commensurate with the diversity and the complexity of the vendor landscape. So we have tremendous, you know, new opportunities, new capabilities that are out in the market and suppliers that can provide those capabilities. But what that means is we have to get smarter and we have to be a little bit more careful and nuanced in kind of how we approach those qualification activities.
Yeah.
We have enterprise risk assessments that hit the items that you described. And even within those big bucket items across all suppliers, those are germane to all suppliers, we see right now a regularly evolving risk landscape. I think recent events, you know, around financial sustainability, right? One of the key due diligence items we do on a supplier with the Silicon Valley Bank and First Republic and some of the bank failures,
we felt
those ripples in the clinical trial, in the vendor ecosystem, right? We work with suppliers that may have been impacted by that. We see, if you just need to Google it, but if you look at just the cybersecurity and data security threats and issues that have happened just in 2023, if you run that Google search, you'll see a plethora of examples of why that has become a prescient risk and something that we really need to delve deep into. And of course, there's compliance with data privacy laws globally and the evolving interpretations of those. So nothing simple on those enterprise assessments. But then when you layer it, you get a little bit further beneath it. For GCP vendors specifically, there's additional quality and compliance requirements pertinent to the category of service you're looking at that require even further deep dives into computer system validation, into how they manage change and their software lifecycle procedures for validated systems. There's functional assessments, just understanding from the business how can a supplier support and align to the requirements and the increasing expectations the business has over service delivery, quality, integration into our ecosystem as a sponsor organization. All of this, while you're trying to align on an appropriate cost structure and pricing model and making sure that you're meeting your requirements there, that there's good chemistry and relationships, you know, within the sponsor supplier domain, then the teams that are working together, and that you're introducing some level of innovation into the relationship and making sure that that's continued to be fostered. So I think, you know, in total, the bar is getting higher. We're seeing a much more technical and much more diverse and complex ecosystem of capabilities that have come to the market, and that's made the qualification process that much more technical, diverse, and complex.
Not simple at all. Okay. All right. So let's talk averages, but also personal bests in terms of the time and capital investment of companies when choosing their partners. Do you have any current or at least recent figures on what is being spent on these sorts of assessments?
Sure. So at the time that we studied this in collaboration with Ken Getz and the Tuft and the folks over at Tufts, the average total time, if you looked across across all different sizes of sponsor companies, just the average total time for a sponsor to perform a vendor qualification and bring a vendor on board, it was almost 5 months for a single service and nearly 7 months for multi-service providers, meaning either, you know, a fuller service CRO or if you're coupling multiple capabilities with a common non-CRO supplier. So that puts it at around, if you just look at those, you know, squared into the middle, that's about 6 months. And just speaking from personal recent experience, about 6 months is where I put my ballpark, when we're looking at bringing on a new supplier. We do that mental math to think about, okay, well, when will those capabilities, when will we be through all the qualification and whatnot? It's about 6 months to get from start to finish around that where you can actually use that supplier. Now, I will say, as much as that's an average, you know, across all the different sizes, there were significant differences that we saw if you look at the company size and the type. And one of the things that stood out was those conducted by the larger companies, a high percentage of those conducted by the large companies involved even further customized assessment areas. So I think what you see there is as companies grow and get more complex, their needs, you know, to operate within their ecosystem, within their culture, within their operating infrastructure becomes more complex. And so you end up seeing more customization of the assessment areas to really understand how a supplier can function in that ecosystem. So the net of that is it takes a long time and typically not, you know, we don't have the luxury of time in clinical research when we're looking to start up studies.
Customization is needed in larger companies, but it also makes it a less efficient process. Is that what you're saying?
It can. I think it introduces additional steps, additional requirements. I think, you know, there's some opportunities and we'll probably talk about this later, but I think there is merit. It's not without value to be able to focus in on some of the nuanced needs. Mm-hmm. I think it's just how we go about this process that probably is ripe for a little bit of change.
Yeah. Well, I was struck by the, you know, greater speed accomplished by CROs in completing the vendor qualification assessment process. And if this is the case, why wouldn't all sponsors want to start outsourcing this work?
So it is interesting. I mean, when you look at it, it looked like, so if we just look at productivity, if we think about, you know, how many resources we're throwing on it. So the CROs were moving quicker. We look at how many resources, at least, you know, when we published this work in 2020, it was, the research was done in 2019. So we're looking at 2018 numbers, right? So we looked at the full year. The productivity from a CRO appeared roughly two times on an FTE basis, what sponsors are doing, meaning, on a per FTE basis, you can get twice as many vendor qualifications through. And so it does beg that question. I think a couple of things that come out of the observations for me is, I think the CROs are a little bit more mature in the space on the whole, right? They've been acting as the general contractor, if you will, for industry for much longer, probably on average, than many organizations have been involved in outsourcing. And so they've had to, as a product of maturity, develop some pretty strong systems and processes. If we were to look at them on a maturity curve, I think they'd be farther to the right. Mm-hmm. The other piece of it is they operate primarily off a labor arbitrage model. So they're incentivized to be able to be as efficient as possible, whereas labor arbitrage isn't the core competency or the model for pharma companies that are in the drug development business. And so there's a little bit less of a push there. They can be a little bit probably more generous in terms of how they approach things and how they resource things. which is necessitated oftentimes by just the complexity of those organizations. Mm. So I think those are two things that are probably underlying it. But to get to your question around, you know, is there a reticence or why aren't we pushing more towards the CROs? I think it does have to do a little bit with, you know, with risk appetite. I think, mm. you know, sponsors are in general, especially in lieu of where the focus has been in terms of vendor oversight and what we've seen from regulators around that, what's been put out there in guidance around our responsibilities around vendor oversight, in particular third parties, even when we're outsourcing to a CRO. I think there's a reticence to outsource the actual qualification activities. I think especially when a sponsor is going to hold a contract and have that oversight responsibility directly over a supplier, then I think that, you know, that drives a sponsor to want to hold those activities. When you're subbing it out through a CRO, you have a little bit more latitude, but I think that just puts more pressure on your understanding of how the CRO is qualifying those vendors. It also depends on the role of the vendor. I mean, some of the lower impact areas, translations, for an example, we may be all too happy to sub that out and to ask a CRO to do those qualifications on our behalf. I think when you get into the higher risk, higher impact vendors supporting a primary endpoint, that becomes a little bit of a different story. But again, it comes back to that risk appetite for the organization.
Makes total sense. Total sense. And I want to get to something you alluded to at the very beginning about personal relationships. I think you were talking about they must matter. They always do. How does that play out at big companies where experts are pooled in different functional groups like quality assurance, procurement, clinical outsourcing management, clinical operations, possibly with overlapping or even conflicting roles in the vendor selection process? How does this play out?
Yeah, it's a great question. So it's unavoidable. I think there are so many dimensions to outsourcing relationships, and there's so many different functions involved that cross-functional complexity and coordination, it's unavoidable, and it's advisable to have subject matter experts in each respective domain to really look at a given, you know, vendor and their capabilities through the lens that's meaningful to them. So it's a necessary evil in a way, but a couple of things that happen around, a couple of challenges. You highlighted objectives may conflict between different functions. I think a classic example of that is operations, clinical operations wanting the optionality and the autonomy over vendor selection, and your typical procurement group wanting to consolidate the number of vendors on the list and have a little bit more control and direct the spend. That can be, that's the red card, right? That's the issue. The green card around that, I think, and where we can overcome those sorts of challenges is just having very strong cross-functional alignment for the overall strategy for the business. So using the sponsor's overall business strategy as the North Star for all the groups, that becomes more difficult, frankly, as you know, to sustain as you get bigger. I've observed that, you know, as growing a few organizations and under the organization I'm with now through its growth. However, I think that's where the leader relationships, like you mentioned, really matter. I think mm-hmm. if you have strong leader relationships, and you can get that alignment at that level, and again, that making sure that aligns to the enterprise strategy, that's where you can drive it down more effectively into your organization so that the teams, you know, the tactical teams, the folks that are living the day to day, are all oriented in the right space and collaborating effectively. Now, that being said, change happens. People leave a company, they get mm-hmm. separated, we have a leader change, and there are some things that just get lost. I mean, I think the tacit knowledge that comes with understanding a company's culture and some of maybe the unwritten processes or less well-documented processes, the subject matter expertise, those are all challenges. I think they're present in all domains. It's the changes, it's however, the changes in leadership, I think, and some of the past relationships with the vendors that are really hard to replace. Some of that, like the relationship level things, you just need to rebuild and focus on that. But the knowledge sharing, the information about and the past experience with a supplier, the understanding of what a supplier can do, and some of all the artifacts of doing a qualification and doing a vendor evaluation, that's where I think some good documentation practice and a strong information management system is a valued asset for an organization to mitigate that.
And that brings me to my next question. as to why isn't the vendor selection process more standardized within or across companies? Aren't there at minimum standard templates for RFIs, RFPs, questionnaires to make an initial assessment of vendor capabilities, et cetera? What exists out there currently, and is there maybe various standardization efforts that aren't standardized more generally?
So that's a question I was asking myself, I think, 15 years ago when I sat on the other side of the table, running an e-commerce firm. And then I think I scratched my head and asked it, you know, for many years, you know, at Avoca. Now I think I'm sitting scratching my head asking that same question at Jazz. So the best that we have in terms of alignment, I think, around requirements is what's explicitly called out in regulations and guidance. And there's very little that's actually explicit in that. I think a lot of it's left to interpretation and some of it to as appropriately so, to adaptation according to your company's requirements, your available resources, and your risk appetite. However, even with that, even with a fairly, you know, reasonable framework from the regulators in terms of guidance and regulation, there are no really officially recognized standards or templates for RFIs and things like that. The closest I've seen to this in my personal experience was the work the Avoca Group did around RFI templates. Those were developed through a pre-competitive consortia. So that was a bunch of pharma and suppliers and CROs and other non-CROs vendors coming together to really help develop some templates around that. But they're not fit for purpose for all sponsors. The RFX documents, the qualification activities, these need to be fit for purpose to where a sponsor is, what their pipeline entails, what their experience and their oversight capabilities are, what their available resourcing structure is, how they're outsourcing, those sorts of things. So, you know, developing a one-size-fits-all approach isn't likely to be entirely possible, but I think there is an opportunity to make progress so that we can focus on those specific nuances I mentioned earlier and those customized areas, and not on the 80 to 90% of things that are common requirements from all sponsors, because they do ultimately come from regulations, guidance, best practice, things like that.
Yeah, standardized by default. And you also provided a nice segue again here, because I wanted to get to next the another conclusion of the report you authored on the vendor qualification topic about how more effective and robust internal data sharing and pre-competitive information sharing on routinely assessed areas might help, in fact, reduce cycle times, as well as more the need to have more risk-based approaches. Can you tell me more about what specifically was meant by this that companies might reasonably act on?
Yeah, so for me, it's the Pareto's rule. I think, you know, 80% of the outcome driven by 20% of the causes, the 80-20 rule. Mm-hmm. I don't see that the 80% of topics we repeatedly ask our CROs and other vendors that really drive any meaningful outcomes, any actionable outcomes. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't inquire about these and verify this information. It's absolutely important that our vendors fulfill those requirements. It just means that where we look at our limited amount of resources and how we can invest those most efficiently, we need to allocate that investment more so to the 20% that truly differentiates what the best fit is in terms of a vendor for our specific needs, and then find a very effective way, a very efficient way to cover off on those other 80%. Hmm. The way to do that, I think the way to drive that efficiency over the 80% is to increase the liquidity of the information. The same way increased liquidity helps a capital market operate more efficiently, the higher level of liquidity you can have over information around a vendor, you know, information you can use to complete your qualification activities in that market between sponsors and vendors, the more efficiently we can really finish assessing that information, that 80% or 90% that we have to look at, but maybe it doesn't really drive as much of the value in terms of performance and downstream health in a partnership and things like that. If we can take that into a more effective way, and I think there's technologies out there that are emerging, platform approaches, things like that that can get us there. That allows us just to put more resources investment in and get more quickly to those deeper conversations about the more bespoke items, that 20% that perhaps differentiates the decision we might make, really informs on the relationship we might need to build, those sorts of things. And, you know, and so that's what I think the opportunity space is around this.
Okay, now I must then bring up here the clinical platform recently developed by Marina Filstinsky and Michael Lieberman, longtime producers of the Scope Conferences, my parent company, specifically to help would-be partners find one another and get down to business faster. What can you speak to about this B2B market network and how big of a dent it is making or is likely to make in the vendor qualification process?
Yeah, so I don't have direct experience with Clinico, so I wanted to call that out. I do think it's great to see Clinico amongst other multiple players in this space. I think for me, when I start to see these solutions emerge, I think it's a signal that one of the main challenges is starting to be overcome. It's a signal for me that sponsors are more receptive to the idea of pre-competitive sharing of information. And I think that's a good thing because how fast we qualify a vendor should never be a way that as a sponsor, I want to differentiate myself from another sponsor, right? We should all be moving as efficiently as possible in this process and really focus our competitive interests around getting medicines to patients. Mm-hmm. So I think it's wonderful that it's happening. I think it's a signal that there's appetite for it in the market as we see these solutions pop up, you know, in Clinico being one of them. And I think it has the potential to help, you know, drive what I described earlier as that liquidity in the information market to help expedite things. I think if you can reduce the time it takes to identify who the suppliers are in a given category, if you can very quickly get information to help you first filter out who might be, you know, worthy of, you know, worth further consideration, deeper consideration, and if you can quickly get the information that then helps you do that next level filtering to really understand who the best partners for consideration are and ultimately make that decision, that's, you know, that's that kind of speed, I think, brings some tangible value. It reduces the resources. We talked about cycle time. It reduces the cycle time. And there is a dollar impact to this. We looked at that in the study, and there is some spend on this. So you can have a bottom line impact on that, you know, to a degree as well. So I think overall, I think it's got the potential. The challenge I would put out there to myself and to other folks representing sponsors is to really, can you think about and can you challenge yourself to think about how you could adopt this, how you could bring about the cultural change within your organization, what it might mean from a process perspective, you know, really, really understand, you know, how can you ready yourself for adopting of these techniques? Because the external pressures are putting it on us that we don't have the luxury to be inefficient anywhere, I think, in drug development. So this is an area where I think there's some quick wins.
Okay, very good. Thank you for that. I appreciate you going there. I have one final question I'd like to end with, and that's what to make of your published finding that most current vendor assessments, more than 90%, result in a vendor being qualified to work with a sponsor. Should we be interpreting this to mean that there are a lot of good choices out there, or more concerningly, that we aren't better weeding out partners who aren't, in fact, a good fit?
Yeah, so I think, you know, this is the million-dollar question, and I don't know that our processes today actually answer it. And it's really around how do you predict or better encourage downstream performance, right? What can you do in the qualification process that really ensures you've got downstream performance from your suppliers and you've really made the best decision you can? Mm-hmm. I think of all the questions we ask, and we ask a lot in some of the RFX documents and the bid defense meetings, I think of in all the documents we look at when we audit and do all these other things, there is still something eluding us in terms of the actual, you know, what actually predicts delivery at the project level. So for me, it's not so much when we see that high volume of ones that are, you know, that are ending up in a positive qualification. I think what that tells me is, you know, we're spending a lot of time validating the things that perhaps we already knew. Perhaps it's that 80 to 90% we're focusing a lot of our energies on. Mm. But if we're finding that we're still being it's elusive as to what's actually really producing downstream success at the project level, at the delivery level, it tells me we're not spending enough time on that, those 20%, right? Those conversations we should really be having that are a little bit deeper, a little bit more nuanced. And I think that that's one of the reasons why you see that high percentage. It's not so much that the trick is weeding out the bad ones or finding the good ones. I think it's really about matching the right supplier relationship to the right organization and the right projects at the right time. And I don't think we're going to get better at that unless we really focus on that 20%. And the only way we're going to get there is to really drive efficiency and come up with a better way to tackle the 80 to 90% that we keep spending a lot of time and resources on.
Gotcha. And Dennis, I'm going to stop right here and say, I know that you are speaking for yourself and not for JS Pharmaceuticals. And I'm going to give you an opportunity to offer that up right now before we close.
Thank you, Deb. And I'd be remiss without saying this. So I've shared a bunch of opinions throughout the call today. I wanted to just call out that these are my personal opinions based on my past experience. They don't necessarily reflect the opinions or position of Jazz Pharmaceuticals or any of my past or current other affiliations with organizations. But thank you for giving me an opportunity to bring that up.
That's okay. It's fine. It is always good in any case to hear from you about new and better ways of operating that affect change in the ways that most matter to companies, ever mindful of budgets and timelines, and perhaps inspire more of the same. Thanks for taking the time to share your wisdom on this pesky issue and ways we might put an end to all the unnecessary inefficiencies and dysfunction one day soon.
Thank you, Deb. Really enjoyed the conversation today.
As did I. And as always, a big thank you to everyone out there for listening in. If you're not subscribed to this podcast yet, please consider going to Apple Podcasts and doing so right now so you don't miss your monthly dose of news and perspectives you'll be hard-pressed to find anywhere else. And if you're up for it, I'd be so very grateful if you'd leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts too. One final note, if you'd liked today's conversation, it's only a glimpse of what we have on tap for CHI's Summit for Clinical Ops Executives events, aka SCOPE. Please plan to join us October 17 and 18 in Barcelona, Spain, and February 11th through 14th in Orlando. For either event, be sure to use discount code SOT10 for a 10% discount off any current rate. For more information, visit scopesummiteurope.com and scopesummit.com. Bye for now.